You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of December 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here at Monocle 24. I'm Ted Kravitz. Coming up on our roundup of the day's news.
Even at India's options have increased today, Russia will remain our most important defense partner.
Indian PM Narendra Modi cozies up to Vladimir Putin after a visit from the Russian Premier. We'll find out what's behind the latest defense deal. From there to the US, and how much George W. Bush actually knew of the CIA's interrogation methods. We'll also be talking chemical weapons in Syria. And with all those stories and more, it's Raffaello Pantucci and Shashank Joshi joining me here in the studio. Also coming up...
It is unacceptable that they use their power to keep us voiceless. Those that have gone before us say no more.
We listen and then thumb through the newly released Golden Globe nominees and ask whether the awards are still actually relevant. We'll also be meeting one of the neighbours of our new Tokyo bureau in Tomigawa and be sampling some stories fresh from one of America's top weeklies. That's all to come over the next 60 minutes here on Midori House. Plenty on the programme then, but first here's Suzanne Chislett with the latest world news.
Palestinian youths have clashed with Israeli soldiers following the burial of Minister Ziad Abu Ain. He died after being grabbed by the neck by an Israeli policeman during a protest in the West Bank. Israeli and Palestinian officials have issued conflicting accounts over the results of a joint Palestinian, Jordanian and Israeli autopsy. But Chen Kugel, head of the Israeli National Institute of Forensic Medicine, insists the main facts are not disputed.
There is no evidence that he was beaten in the chest by a gun or any other instrument. The signs in the chest are due to resuscitation, and we are in total agreement regarding this issue, all the doctors that attended the autopsy.
The former US Vice President Dick Cheney insists President George W. Bush was fully informed about the CIA interrogation techniques, which were condemned in a Senate report. Speaking to Fox News, Mr. Cheney said Mr. Bush knew everything he needed to know about the program. The CIA has defended its use of methods such as waterboarding on terror suspects after the 9/11 attacks, now being studied by governments around the world. A suicide bomber has detonated explosives, killing several people and injuring 16 others during an event at a French-run high school in Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. Earlier, a suicide bomber killed six soldiers and injured 11 more in an attack on a bus carrying military personnel on the outskirts of the city. A clinical trial of an Ebola vaccine in Geneva has been halted after four patients complained of joint pains. An official from the University of Geneva Hospital said all are fine and being monitored. The drug being tested was developed by Merck and NewLink. Trials are due to resume next month. Meanwhile, Guinea's health ministers admitted that the Ebola outbreak has revealed weaknesses in its healthcare system. Dr. Bernice T. Dunn is Liberia's health minister and says more health workers are needed there too.
We want to expand the health workforce, because it's crucial for providing quality health care. We want to increase the number of nurses, midwives, doctors, specialists, and community health workers, and also looking at the managerial cadre, the managers, over the next 10 years. And that budget comes up to about $200 million.
New allegations have emerged that Syria is still using chemical weapons against its own people. Records seen by the Times of London show at least 14 chemical weapon strikes in Syria since April. Just last year, under the threat of international military action, the Syrian government signed the Chemical Weapons Convention, promising it would give up its chemical weapons stocks. Hannah Lucinda Smith, Middle East correspondent for the Times of London, co-wrote the article. She told Monocle 24, events in Syria have enabled government forces to resume the use of weapons containing chlorine.
Since last year, of course, we've had the rise of ISIS. The world's tensions really now are focused on ISIS rather than on what President Assad is doing. So maybe Assad is now feeling that he can quietly and slowly start using these kind of weapons again, Also, chlorine oxide is a bit of a strange status. It's not actually a chemical weapon banned under the Chemical Weapons Convention. It's perfectly legal to keep stocks of chlorine. However, it is illegal to use it in this way against the population.
A South African court has ruled a son of President Jacob Zuma acted negligently when his car hit a minivan in Johannesburg, killing a woman. Didizane Zuma, a millionaire with mining interests, had claimed he lost control in wet conditions. The court has yet to decide whether he'll face culpable homicide charges. The case is the latest scandal to hit the leader of Africa's most advanced economy. He faces criticism over the use of $25 million of public money to upgrade his country home. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo to Buenos Aires
to Zurich to Hong Kong
to Toronto
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, the time here in London, 1806, 1306 in New York City. So we're just coming to the end of the working day here in the UK, and joining me in the studio to mull over and perhaps offer a little analysis of the day's news so far is Raffaello Pantucci and Shashank Joshi, both, of course, doing sterling work at RUSI here in London. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
To Midori House. Now let's start, shall we, with the story that Suzanne had in the news there. Well, I don't know. We should probably call it an amusingly forthright outburst from Dick Cheney on Fox News about who knew what and when and how much George W. Bush knew, and defending, as you'd expect, the CIA. What did you both make of it?
I thought it was dismaying, obviously. I think that he was responsible for some of the worst abuses. What's interesting, of course, is though the report itself exonerates President Bush on a number of counts. It turns out Bush himself didn't know specifics, specific countries, specific methods, and although his lawyers had authorized much of this, that the president was in the dark. Cheney, ironically enough,
It says he didn't know.
The report says he didn't know.
And now Cheney is saying...
And the irony is that you have someone who's now agreeing with left-wing critics who say, well, of course the president knew, and he's being incriminated by his own vice president, the Prince of Darkness himself, which is somehow apt, I think.
Well, I think it's one of these things where he's damned if you do, damned if you don't, right? If he says that he didn't know, well, then he's sort of consciously he doesn't know what's happening with his own system, and that shows a lack of control. On the other hand, if he did know, then he's complicit in all of these problems. I think what was interesting is, if I recall correctly, there was a moment in the report, or there was some reporting indicating that he had specifically asked not to be told certain details so that he wouldn't then be aware of them and then potentially leak them to the media. But that does show a level of awareness of the program that he doesn't want to know about. It's this kind of unknown sort of, you know.
Plausible deniability.
Exactly.
It's not so plausible. But I think if you look at the report, and I've read a lot of it, it's fascinating. I mean, horrifying, disturbing. But what you get is a sense of a huge behemoth of a bureaucracy that is out of control and that is not fully accountable within itself, let alone to the White House. So you have people sitting in little black sites in Thailand or Poland, employing techniques that their superiors in Langley are not aware of. And therefore, it doesn't entirely surprise me that Bush very plausibly may have been in the dark on a great degree of this, but that unfortunately is his own fault for allowing an organization to grow so unaccountable. And I have to say, for the Senate, for all the good work it's done, where was it for all these years?
So perhaps the key is in what Cheney says here, that Bush knew everything he needed to know and perhaps wanted to know, which was...
I'll have to say, I mean, as a general point, in all democratic systems I'm familiar with, the leader often will not know specific operational details about intelligence operations.
Well, you think about the level of business and stuff that he's dealing with. If you're dealing with a nation state, there's a whole raft of things, and knowing the specific details of how X piece of information was obtained is not necessarily of import. What's important is the analysis that goes behind it, and then how it's presented to him about, okay, so we know this because... You don't necessarily need to know all that.
But you would have thought after Abu Ghraib and the incredible strategic effect that individual tactical interrogation methods and, of course, torture methods had, that a president would need to be interested in the minutiae of what his own subordinates were doing.
But I think Abu Ghraib was the high watermark, right, of these things. I think after that moment, there was a sort of turning point within the American system that said, okay, we do need to start looking at this, we need to start investigating it. I think a lot of what we're seeing in the Senate report is incidents that took place before that, before those sorts of revelations.
You're right, there are some that occur afterwards, and there's a lingering sense that actually Abu Ghraib did not terminate this, but you're correct to say it was a turning point in other ways.
Shashank, you mentioned known unknowns. We haven't heard anything from Rumsfeld yet, have we?
No, but someone retweeted a fantastic memo that had emerged of him to Doug Feith, who was his Undersecretary of Defense, in which it was a very sort of short five-line memo that said, you know, line one, we need to be careful about what's happening in Iraq. Line two was, you know, and that whole Pakistan thing is kind of getting out of control. And by the way, let's not forget the Koreas. And then the final thing was, I'm waiting for ideas on how to solve some of these problems. I'm paraphrasing it, but it was just a hilarious sort of note, which I can't remember, someone tweeted it today saying, you know, gosh, this takes me back to the Bush era. What wonderful messages they used to send amongst each other.
Yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right, Shash, to say that if it wasn't so completely horrifying and awful, it would be funny. And one of the things I took from reading bits of the report was actually the money paid to the psychologists.
Oh, God, yeah.
The firm.
I mean, this is astonishing. You've got two contractors.
81 million, I think it was. Million.
Yeah, just a lot of money. Who have no apparent expertise in this subject beyond having done a little bit on resistance techniques and training for the US armed forces, who are paid enormous sums of money, you know, tens of millions of dollars, effectively to tell people how to torture captives and effectively cut off good information by doing so. And they were allowed to vet their own training programs, so there's no feedback or accountability here. And we're talking about two people. What's even more astonishing, of course, is the head of interrogation in 2002 was a man who had earlier been censured for his role in Latin America in the 1980s for encouraging torture methods and supplying torture methods to the Contras fighting the Nicaraguan government. This is the organization we're dealing with, one that rehires people who are disgraced for applying torture in the 80s. It's out of control. You know, I was reading a book on the CIA recently, Timothy Weiner's Legacy of Ashes, and you realize the stuff they were doing in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, giving LSD to inmates, is it all that different to pureeing food and inserting it anally into an inmate to torture him? Not that much.
Yeah. Where do you think this is going in terms of prosecutions?
I don't think it's going to go much further than what we've seen. I think that they've convicted one person for leaking information, but I don't think you're going to see it go much deeper than that, because at the end of the day, you have always got that question. You know, when you're dealing with intelligence services, you do need services who are willing and able to get information and do a job. Now, if they are institutionally concerned that they don't have the political cover all the time, then they might not do things, or they might not do the job that they need to do. So I think that element of political cover will consistently remain. And in some ways, this is something that I think is hamstringing the Obama administration's capacity to respond to any of this, because at the end of the day, they still need the services to work with them, and they still need the services to provide the important job that they do. And so they can't start, you know, digging through the past and accusing people, because then that might affect people who are working now, who will say, well, I'm not going to do anything because I'm concerned about what the ramifications are and the fact that I might get hauled up before a committee and potentially jailed in the future for my activity. So I think you're going to continue to see a line from the administration, which is much more focused on don't leak information, which is more about people breaking the Official Secrets Act or whatever it is in the United States that, you know, you shouldn't, that people sign when they join these sorts of services. But I don't think you're going to see them going much further down the line of prosecuting people. I think the US has a long track record of protecting its own, and I think that's going to continue.
Just a quick final question on this before we move on to our next topic, and that's whether you think what you think actually about the report. Bush has said, Cheney has said that it's, quote, full of crap, it's flat out lies, and all of the rest of it. What do you think?
I think it's a wonderful report. The Senate committee has done a splendid job. It's exhaustive, it's detailed, it's meticulously researched. But I would say a few important things. First of all, it's only limited to asking the question of does torture get good information? And second of all, it did not interview CIA officers. I don't blame the committee for that. The CIA itself refused to allow access to those officers. So don't buy it when the CIA or Cheney says, well, they didn't interview these people. Well, they weren't allowed to. But under those constraints, what they've produced is something that any historian accustomed to dealing with primary sources could be proud of.
Raffaele?
Well, I mean, I think that I think Shashank's right, it's a very good report. I also think that the important element to highlight here is that this is a demonstration of how the American system is accountable to itself, you know, and how we may have issue with what the CIA was doing in this particular case, but at least they have a process which will reveal these sorts of problems and show them to the world. Now, if you think about other countries who will sort of point fingers at the Americans and say, oh, you know, look what you do to your detainees. Well, those countries are doing the same things to their detainees, if not worse, and they're certainly haven't got investigatory committees that are looking into it. And I think that is a bonus and that is an advantage. And I think something that's a proud example that the American system should be at least proud of in this case.
I think you're right, but it's such a fraught process. The CIA hacked into the Senate computers. It tried to restrict the report. The president himself is not taking sides between the Senate and the CIA. So you're correct to say these accountability mechanisms far exceed those of other countries, including our own, by the way. But they are
so far from perfect. Right?
And I think it's still dismaying the president himself is effectively allowing this to be cast aside.
Okay, it's 15 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Shashank Joshi and Raffaele Pantucci joining me, TechRabbits on Midori House. Let's move on to our next topic, and that's the visit of Russian President Vladimir Putin to India and announcements today of perhaps the usual shopping list that we see when we go to these kind of things. Weapons, nuclear power, what are the rest of it?
Yeah, well, I mean, you've pretty much mentioned the entire list. What I did find interesting, I will say one thing, is that the leader of the Crimean region, the so-called Prime Minister of Crimea, also went to Delhi. He met a Crimean investment group in India, and they signed an agreement promising a flow of Indian capital into Crimea and new opportunities. I personally think it's very foolish for a government like India's to be cavorting with separatists who have earned their status by conquest and annexation of territory. But I think it's interesting to see just how different the Russia issue looks from Asia Pacific than it does from sitting here on this island.
I think this is more of Putin traveling the world to show that he has friends other than the Western Europeans, and he doesn't really need all this grief that he's getting in sort of NATO or other European contexts. And so, you know, he goes out to these Eastern countries to try to boost his relationships there. The India-Russia relationship is a very long-standing one. It's very close. I think one of the interesting aspects to me, which hasn't really been flagged up, was that there were weapons involved here, and this is not new because the Indians have always been getting kit from the Russians. But what's interesting is actually, I think it was last month or earlier this month, well, it must have been last month actually, because it was right at the beginning, but the Russians signed a deal with the Pakistanis to sell some attack helicopters to them. And so I'm wondering how much that conversation is going to play in the background somewhere, because, you know, of course, the Indians and the Pakistanis have a constant sort of standoff against each other. And so, you know, does it mean that now they're going to have to sell slightly higher quality, or are they apologizing for that? Or I don't know how that conversation is
going. The backstory here is that while historically, Russia has been a major provider, 2009 to 2013, Russia provided 75% of India's equipment. That is going down and down and down. The Israelis and the Americans are selling more and more. And so to the backdrop of all these sweet words, and it was incredibly positive messaging, Modi said Russia was the most important partnership India had.
Ask any child in India who is India's best friend internationally, and they will tell you that it is Russia.
Extraordinary words. But of course, I think they conceal what is a sense of disillusionment with a declining relationship in the context of a strengthening US-India bond.
Yes, that's the good point, isn't it? Because it's as you say, you know, Apache helicopters were sold by the States to India themselves, and that's, you know, you've got a lot of people courting India. And well, let's move it on. Actually, just on this matter to the nuclear power issue, because you've got also exports and the involvement of Rosneft coming in this, haven't you? They've agreed to supply India with 10 million of tons of oil per year. Nice little deal.
Well, this is part of a broader Chinese shift, isn't it, Raf?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that I think this does go back to the Russians looking for other markets, you know, and they're trying to look to other places they're trying to supply and find places to reach out to. I think, you know, on the energy sector, they've signed, they did a huge deal. They've signed a couple of huge gas deals with the Chinese recently, which actually, if you look at the deals, you wonder if they're really going to come off as they say they are. There's lots of sort of holes in it. I suspect that within this energy deal, there probably are some questions as well. But Rosneft's a company that is, you know, getting aggressively sanctioned on the one hand in the European context, so they've got to go find customers somewhere else, and this is a way to do it. You know, and leaders like to go to these sorts of meetings and sign these big deals where there are sort of lots of numbers thrown around, and energy is a very good way to do that.
And the diamond trade as well. finally. I'm just looking on the story here as if there wasn't anything else they could get into bed about. They're going to be signing an agreement on improving bilateral diamond trade. Russia, of course, the top producer of rough diamonds in the world, and India, the global hub for cutting and polishing the gemstones. So
in Gujarat, no less, right?
Modi's home state. Yeah, the famous diamond polishers and traders.
Exactly.
It's funny how Modi actually manages to flip between this. You know, a month ago, he's in Times Square lording it up and having the big I am, and then he's cozying up to Putin on the other side.
Well, this is what, in a way, a legacy of non-alignment. India's ability to think not in terms of alliances as we do, which involve trade-offs between friends and adversaries, but in terms of loose multipolar partnerships. And that is a very flexible concept that they exploit.
But I think the other element of it is, I think, a rising Asia, which is something we've been talking about for a long time, but I think it's increasingly obvious. And now you've got, because the Chinese do the same thing, right? Xi Jinping can go around the world and have high-level meetings pretty much with anyone. He can maintain good relations with the Europeans and the Russians at the same time. He can maintain good relationships of some level with the Americans, while he's got tensions on the other hand. So, you know, and I think it's the Indians is the same thing. These are the big rising Asian powers that are starting to sort of see that their sort of heft in international affairs is something they can really throw around much more as they would like to dictate, rather than being kind of pushed around by some of the other powers.
If you're rich and powerful and you will have sway, everyone will want to be friends with you, and they will not be in a position to say, sorry, you can't be friends with that other person over there.
Exactly.
Indeed. Okay, well, let's leave India and Russia now and continue with today's revelations. In the Times newspaper here in London, that the Syrian government forces have still been using chemical weapons even after signing the Chemical Weapons Convention. According to the Times, chlorine would have been used as many as 14 times since April this year. We have the story here in front of us, the headline, Assad chlorine bombs rain silent terror on Damascus. So what is important, the story comes out. Is there any real surprise?
No, he's been doing this for over a year, actually. The scale is new. The frequency is reported by the Times in very good fashion. But actually, right when the deal was signed, people pointed out, the deal I'm referring to, of course, is a chemical weapons deal last year, which the US agreed to by cancelling missile strikes to punish Syria's use of sarin, and instead said we'll disarm Syria and export all the chemical weapons. People said, actually, chlorine is not a chemical weapon under the Chemical Weapons Convention. And they've been using this, therefore, continuously afterwards. But others will still say, actually, why on earth are you Westerners sitting here looking at stories on chlorine? He's still dropping quite normal unchemical explosions on us every day, killing tens of thousands. So what's so special about chlorine?
No, I think Shashank's right. This is exactly what's so depressing about the sort of serious situation is we get caught up in these semantic debates about aspects of it, that the actual civil war continues to go on and people continue to die and suffering is happening. And so in some ways, the anger that you see emanating from communities in Western Europe and some of the people who are motivated to go over there and fight against it, it's specifically for this reason. The fact that we sit here and debate the fact that, oh, is chlorine a weapon or not? And should it be on the list? And oh my gosh, what are we doing? The man is killing his people and continues to do this, and no one is really doing anything about it that they can see. So it does stoke up this anger. So, you know, a lot of the problems that we're seeing flow from Syria internationally are in many ways a product of this sort of a conversation.
And yet, what seems to be done about it?
Nothing. Well, I think nothing in a sense, but the Americans have a strategy, which is Iraq first and ISIL first, which implicitly means Syria second, Assad second. But what they are heading the direction of very clearly is not a military push to remove Assad, but a political solution that brings the Iranians, the Russians, the Saudis around a table. All of the signs from the White House, from General Allen, the envoy to the coalition against ISIL, point in that direction. And I think that sometime next year we will probably see another push at a kind of Geneva III supplant what failed at the beginning of this year.
But the thing that worries me about any sort of push in that direction is that I bet that it's going to continue in the same path as before, which is you don't have people like ISIS at the table, right? And frankly, that's ridiculous. When you're dealing with a battlefield where one of the strongest actors and most sort of, you know, one of the actors controls the biggest piece of territory on the ground is not even involved in the discussions, well, then why are you having the discussions?
Well, the idea is that you by the time you've got to that conference, you've degraded ISIS. That's the hope. It'll take a year to train up Syrian rebels on the ground.
But then even if you degrade ISIS, there's a question of, do you bring Jabhat al-Nusra to the table? I mean, this is al-Qaeda's affiliate on the ground. You bring Ahrar al-Sham to the table.
The line is going to be drawn, I think, on the al-Qaeda side. Al-Qaeda will not be at a table involving Saudi Arabia and Iran. Ahrar al-Sham and others, well, possibly one day in the future.
Okay, well, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Joining me in the studio, Raffaello Pantucci and Shashank Joshi. Still to come, we'll be looking ahead and try and forecast some things about what 2015 might have in store for us. Stay tuned.
The Cafe Pacific experience is one of ease and exploration, introducing a contemporary Asian experience to international travel. By placing service at its core, Cafe Pacific evolves with its passengers, creating a home away from home in its lounges and aircraft. Having built its name on service and quality, Cafe Pacific has helped turn its Hong Kong home into a premier transport hub, making the airline one of the world's leading aviation brands. Find out how Cathay Pacific is flying into 2015 and get the view beyond the horizon in The Forecast, the brand new magazine from the editors and bureau of Monocle.
Past the hour, just heading towards the bottom of the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me in the studio, Raffaello Pantucci and Shashank Joshi. Now, on a newsstand near you now is the latest publication from Monocle. The Forecast is our look into a crystal ball, perhaps, of the year to come, 2015. But Raffaello and Shashank, basing on your expertise and considerable foresight, what kind of things are you predicting for the next 12 months or so?
Well, I'm looking at Pakistan and its increasing instability, domestic violence, jihadist activity, sectarian warfare. And what really worries me is the increasing confidence of the Pakistan army and the increasing confidence and space of ostensibly social actors like Hafiz Saeed, leader of Lashkar-e-Taiba, who are getting more and more space in Pakistani civil society. But these are people who lead potent jihadist groups. Lashkar-e-Taiba committed a major siege against Mumbai, is it now 7 years ago, 2008? Mm. What worries me is the pressure is building up with activity on the line of control. Mm. Pakistan-Indian relations are extremely bad, the worst they've been in years. I'm going to predict, and with obvious regard for uncertainty here, a major attack in India that's going to possibly provoke some kind of standoff or Indian airstrikes. And I think that possibility is a real one, and we have to be thinking about it now.
It's been a tinderbox for as long as we can all remember. You think it actually might...
We've had attacks before. Mumbai was the obvious example. We've had other attacks since. But it's what really worries me is a big symbolic attack against Indian leaders, the Indian seat of government, parliament, MPs, politicians. It's that kind of thing that could spark off a huge Indian hysteria. And the more and more powerful and vocal the middle class gets, the more jingoistic the Indian press gets, the more powerful they feel, the more they will be willing to retaliate in the way they have not done in the last 20 years.
Okay, we'll talk politics and economy in a second. But Raffaello, what have you are you looking forward to?
I think there's a few things. I think the main one that I would flag up is to look at China, and I think to look at what we've seen the Chinese talking about over the past year really goes back to September last year, where Xi Jinping in Astana gave a speech in which he talked about the Silk Road economic belt and this being one of the big Chinese visions for foreign policy in the future. And I think it builds on a sort of foreign policy that we're increasingly seeing Xi Jinping talk about, which is building on border relationships and building these sorts of trade and economic corridors. And what's interesting over the past year is we've started to see them talk about in more specific terms what it actually looks like, and even more convincingly, to put financing on the table and to actually put money down. And I think next year we're going to really start to see this actually come together. And I think it's really one of the most significant sort of underwatched geopolitical shifts, because in essence here, what China's doing is trying to reconnect itself to the world in a number of different contexts, to turn itself as the sort of international trade hub. The Middle Kingdom is kind of restoring itself as the Middle Kingdom of international affairs and rewiring all sort of international trade routes so they all flow back to China. And I think that has repercussions that we're going to really feel for the next decade, really. And I think it's just going to be on its way. I think next year you're going to really start to see it actually come together in more specific terms than we've had so far, which has been a bit more on the sort of rhetoric side and a bit more on the sort of loose understanding. I think next year we'll really start to see actually what this means and what the implications of it are.
These are things we were only talking about in abstract terms 15 years ago. And it's interesting, we are witnessing the process of a major power rising and a system changing as a result. And it's very, very different from the last major shift we've had. Shifts like the Anglo-German rivalry and tucked into Europe. It's very different. There are nuclear weapons in the picture here. Mm. Economies are more interconnected than they were. it's strange to see.
And at its very heart, you've got this foreign this power that has not really decided what its role in foreign policy is going to be. You know, it hasn't decided that it's going to be the sort of benign hegemon or the sort of global policeman. It hasn't really sort of figured that out. And so you're going to start to see that get figured out in a very kind of visceral way, in a kind of reactive fashion, which is in some ways the worst kind of fashion.
And coming up against another power that sees itself in a very fixed, rigid sense as the world's indispensable power and the world's policeman and stabilizer.
Right. Right.
And that's a toxic combination.
Yeah, it is.
All right. And just briefly, there'll be elections in various countries. The UK's having an election next year. European economies will probably continue to slow or grow very, very slowly. And then, of course, we've got the preview to the US elections in 2016, which we'll be hearing a lot about next year, won't we? We'll get some ideas of candidates.
Secretary Clinton. Madam Secretary.
I think in 2 years, we're going to be seeing President Clinton meeting with a Prime Minister Farage. So I think wait for that moment. Right?
Well, that'll be fantastic. Yeah, there's some suggestion, of course, that David Miliband, an itinerant wandering around Washington at the moment, or New York with a chat with international charity, might be taken on board Hillary Clinton's staff. So who knows?
Yes.
You could see Secretary Miliband.
Could well do. Raffaello Pantucci, Shashank Joshi, thank you so much for joining us here at Midori House.
Thank you.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Still to come in the second half of today's Midori House, a look through who's made the nomination list for this season's Golden Globes. We meet the neighbours of Monocle's new shop and office in Tokyo, and we're live to our bureau in New York City. But before we get started on that, here's Suzanne again with the latest world news.
Thank you, Ted. Palestinian officials say they may suspend security cooperation with Israel following the death of a government minister. Ziad Abu Ain died after he was grabbed by the throat by an Israeli officer during a protest in the West Bank. The former US Vice President Dick Cheney insists President George W. Bush was fully informed about the CIA interrogation techniques, which were condemned in a Senate report this week. Speaking to Fox News, Mr. Cheney said Mr. Bush knew everything he needed to know about the program. The French government says several people have been killed in an explosion at a French-run school in Kabul. The Afghan government says a teenage suicide bomber carried out the attack, which also left more than a dozen people injured. And Hong Kong police and bailiffs have cleared large parts of the main pro-democracy protest site near the heart of the financial centre. It marks an end to more than 2 months of street demonstrations. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
You're listening to Midori House live here on Monocle 24. The time, 21:33 in Moscow, 18:33 here in London, and 16:33 in Rio de Janeiro. And it's time of the week when we leaf through some of the fresh news weeklies around the world. Today, it's turn of the US. And joining me from Monocle's New York office is our bureau chief there, Ed Stocker. Hi, Ed.
Hi, how's it going?
Very well, thank you. Well, how's it going with you? Is the afternoon, early afternoon crisp there on Broadway?
It is indeed. There was a flurry of snow yesterday. Still pretty nippy here.
Okay. All right. So what have we got? What should we start with? Perhaps we'll look at Bloomberg and Time in a moment. But what a news week going with this week.
Yeah, sure. Okay, let's start with that. Basically, the cover headline is Science to the Rescue, Rebooting the Planet. So this is essentially a piece looking at global warming and some of the ways of tackling it. Quite an interesting idea is this concept called geoengineering, which is basically harnessing the power of the planet to help absorb carbon gases. And so this is what the focus of the what the article is about. Well, it starts looking at how ants can actually absorb carbon, will convert carbon in their boring techniques and the way they tunnel. And then it looks at kind of various different other animals that do similar things, including plankton. And sort of these kind of ideas that are in there bear just kind of concepts at the moment that haven't really been explored fully. Some of the ways we can bring the Earth's temperature down. Another idea is spraying sulfates, in essence kind of recreating a volcano, which kind of blocks some of the radiation getting to the getting through to the Earth, and also brings down the temperature of the planet. But actually, kind of, it concludes saying that these are all great ideas that can kind of reverse some of the previous damage that's been done. But, you know, essentially, human beings need to change the way they live on the planet if the real problem's going to be tackled, I guess.
Yeah, I think spraying sulfur into the air might have us all reaching, or should that be retching, for our handkerchiefs.
Sulfates, not sulfur.
Oh, well, that's
sulfates.
Good. Oh, well, thank heaven for that. But yeah, that's a good point that they make then at the end, that it's all part of being a part of the solution rather than the problem, and treating the cause rather than the effect.
Indeed, indeed. But I mean, this ant thing is just pretty crazy. And apparently there are 10 quadrillion ants on this planet. A fact for you there.
Good. All right. I like that one. Let's move on to time, shall we? And I think, was it last week they were going with their People of the Year, for which they chose health workers treating the Ebola virus. What are they doing this week?
Indeed. Well, Mark Zuckerberg is on the cover. I have to say, I'm not a huge fan of this cover. He kind of looks a little washed out and grinning rather scarily on the cover in a bare room. But it's essentially looking at the future of Facebook. We all know, you know, that it's passed 1 billion users. We all know what it's been up to in its first decade. But this is trying to look ahead to see what it's going to do in the decade that comes. And essentially, it's the lead piece is a story that follows Zuckerberg about particularly some of the work he's doing in India. And essentially what Facebook is trying to do, it's teamed up with a whole load of other companies, other tech companies, to form this this group called internet.org. And they're trying to essentially get the whole world online. That's their colossal aim, is to bring get the entire planet connected. I guess the question remains, why do they want to do that? And this is kind of what the article argues. Do they want to do it for good reasons? And there's studies to suggest that, you know, getting people online in the third world connects them to the world, makes them feel included, educates them, brings down crime, even creates jobs. So that, I guess that's kind of the good side. The other side would be, well, do they have other reasons for doing this? Are these, you know, potential people that can be exploited in the future? Perhaps exploited is the wrong word, but used for marketing terms. You know, while many of them might not be that rich at the moment, these are all potential clients, I guess, for Facebook and Facebook advertising. So I guess it's kind of looking at those two sides of the argument about what Facebook is doing and the reasons behind it.
Well, it's important that they do look at both sides, don't they? Because, I mean, generating data is inherently valuable, isn't it? Any data on anybody is valuable. You can do something or sell something with that. But it's about achieving a balance, isn't it? It's the idea of everybody in the world being connected like this is rather horrifying.
Well, yeah. Well, I've just been reading a book actually called The Circle by Dave Eggers that kind of looks at a slightly more doomsday approach to a Google-esque company doing these sorts of things. I think, you know, apparently 85% of the world already has access to the internet, although not everyone is using it. So actually people are close enough to the internet or have family members that have it, etc. I guess the scary thing is that 15% that's left and what people want to do. You know, one of internet.org is talking about, although it's one of the, you know, the less principal aims, I guess, it's talking about launching drones into the sky to make sure that every inch of the planet, you know, has internet connectivity, including, you know, desert areas. And for me personally, the thought of every inch of the world having Wi-Fi is a little bit scary.
It is indeed. Okay, let's move on finally to Bloomberg Businessweek.
Indeed. I have to say, I find this magazine pretty busy. There's a whole load of text and graphics on the front cover. But the main central image in the middle is a picture of a Nike trainer, Air Jordans, from 1985. Actually, the reason that this is on the cover, which I guess isn't a particularly newsy story, is because the magazine, formerly known as Business Week, obviously became Bloomberg Business Week in 2010, is celebrating 85 years. So what they've done is they've come up with 85 ideas throughout those 85 years. So they're covering, it's kind of a historically themed piece. So they're looking at everything from the creation of Twitter back in 2006, it seems like it's been around for longer than that, to the first sale of bottled water in 1977, to the invention of the Polaroid camera in 1947. But the cover story is looking at Air Jordans, which I don't know if you remember back to 1985 were a bit of a phenomenon.
I do, yeah. They were never really up my street, but I do remember them well.
You didn't have a pair?
No, I certainly didn't. But yeah, no, I remember them well. Anyway, listen, a trip back in the past. Listen, Ed, thanks very much. That's all we've got time for. Ed Stocker, Monocle's bureau chief there in New York, with a little look at the week's news weeklies in the States. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Up next, the nominations for this year's Golden Globes are out, and we'll be taking a look.
Global affairs, culture, business, design, or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas, or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Minutes past the hour. Welcome back to Midori House. Now it's Hollywood's awards season again, and this year's list of Golden Globe nominees has just been released. As usual, it's a pretty international list, so to give his thoughts on some of the nominees, and indeed to assess how important the Golden Globes still are, is the Daily Telegraph's film critic, Tim Robey. Hi, Tim.
Hello.
Now let's have a look. What do you want to look at? First of all, some of the movies themselves. We've got some interesting ones amongst them. Boyhood, The Imitation Game, Selma.
Selma. Now, this is really interesting. It's one of the last films to have been screened in the kind of run-up to this. Mm. And it's done extremely well. It's been nominated for Best Film as a Drama, Best Director, and Best Actor for David Oyelowo as playing Martin Luther King. So it sounds like a biopic. It's not really. It focuses only on one incident in 1965 in the town of Selma, Alabama. But I think it's a phenomenal film. It's picking up a lot of momentum as a big awards player. I actually think at the end of the day, we're going to see a bit of a photo finish probably between Selma and Boyhood, Richard Linklater's film, which has lasted the distance, even though it premiered nearly a year ago in Berlin. In fact, Sundance, even longer ago. So those two, I think, are big contenders, and they've been nominated across various categories.
Mm, okay, you mentioned David Oyelowo. Who else is in Selma? Who else stars?
So it has some other British cast members. Tom Wilkinson plays LBJ in it, who has a number of kind of very combative scenes with King. And Carmen Ejogo plays King's wife. She's very good. Tim Roth's in it. So it's got a good cast, but David is definitely getting the kind of awards attention for it. He's really good. I think he's never given a better performance. And he's going to be competing against Benedict Cumberbatch as Alan Turing in The Imitation Game, and also Eddie Redmayne playing Hawking in The Theory of Everything.
Indeed, yeah. No, as usual, a big British representation in the nominees. Okay, well, talking about Selma, here's a clip.
Mr. President, Dr. King is here.
Mr. President, in the South, there have been thousands of racially motivated murders.
We need your help,
Dr. King. This thing's just going to have to wait.
It cannot wait.
You've got one big issue, I got 101.
Summer it is.
Here is the next great battle.
Selma's the place, and they ready.
Dr. King!
I tell you, that white boy can hit.
You will not tolerate agitators attempting to orchestrate a disturbance in this state.
It is unacceptable that they use their power to keep us voiceless. Those that have gone before us say no more.
Okay, so that's a clip from Selma there, complete, replete with the usual eccentric music and
absolutely. It sounds like a Mandela or something, doesn't it? But Mandela was a very disappointing film. I think this one is much better directed. Ava DuVernay, the director, has become the first ever black woman to be nominated for the Golden Globe. I think she'll repeat that with the Oscar nominations as well.
Okay, all right. We'll talk about that in a moment. Talking of music, actually, I did note that Hans Zimmer has been nominated for Interstellar. I'm sure you've seen Interstellar. It sounds like someone's playing the church organ.
It's very organy, isn't it? Yeah, I actually really like that score. I kind of think it kind of gives the film an aura that it needs. So I was quite pleased with that nomination. Interstellar has otherwise really not been nominated for much at all. And neither has Angelina Jolie's film Unbroken. It's been kind of cut out, really. People were expecting one or two nominations for that.
You think maybe people were sort of picking the holes in some of Interstellar's plot twists?
Very possibly, yeah. And I think even more so Unbroken's kind of cheesiness and it's quite a lame film, I think.
Okay. Let's move on to Birdman.
Birdman is a real tour de force for Alejandro González Iñárritu, the guy who brought us Babel and stuff like that. And Michael Keaton has this fantastic comeback performance in it, playing kind of a variation on himself because the character is a sort of a slightly washed up former film star who used to play a comic book character. And they've classed this one as a comedy. It is kind of a dark comedy. It is funny. But it's one of those ones where it's a sort of slightly touch and go decision. The Globes do this thing where they separate everything into either comedy and musical or drama. And they've put Birdman in the comedy category, where I think Michael Keaton will definitely win for Best Actor.
Yeah, it's interesting you mention that, because the other nominees for Best Motion Picture, Musical or Comedy, apart from Birdman, are Into the Woods, Pride, St. Vincent, and The Grand Budapest Hotel, which I must say was one of my favourite movies of last year.
I love that film. I'm really glad it's done so well. It actually also got Wes Anderson nominated for Best Director, and Ralph Fiennes for Best Actor in a Comedy. He'll be up against Keaton. And I do think it's one of Anderson's best films. And another film that premiered a long time ago in February in Berlin and has managed to last the course and is now getting some good awards attention.
Okay, you mentioned the Best Actor noms, which are Benedict Cumberbatch, Eddie Redmayne, Jake Gyllenhaal, David Oliwoo, as we said, and Steve Carroll.
Now, those are all in the drama category.
And
then over in comedy, we have a different bunch of people. We have Michael Keaton,
we have
Ralph Fiennes. And some others. Those two, though, will be the kind of the biggest players, I think.
Okay. And what about the actresses? Any standouts in that?
Yeah, I mean, what I love here is that Julianne Moore has managed to get two nominations. She's going to win, I think, in the drama section for Still Alice, which is a film that played in Toronto, where she plays a character with early onset Alzheimer's. She's fantastic. She's never won an Oscar, and in the long run, she will win the Oscar for that as well. But alongside that, in comedy, they've classed David Cronenberg's Maps to the Stars as a comedy. It's a very, very black one. It's a sort of satire at Hollywood's expense. But she's been nominated for that. She is the funniest thing in it. And she actually has a chance to win both those awards, which would be quite funny because I don't want to give a spoiler, but there's a scene in Maps to the Stars where a Golden Globe or something very like it is used as a weapon to beat someone to death. So if she wins two of them, that would be quite comical.
Okay, so it is a useful murder weapon, but how relevant are the Golden Globes still?
They're sort of part of the picture. They always have been. And they're also quite a fun sideshow in some ways because of this comedy category, you end up getting some winners that you won't then get to see at the Oscars. You know, you get films being chosen for completely different reasons. But in the drama section, it's still seen as a bit of a pointer towards what will be the ultimate kind of goal of winning an Oscar. And in the case of Julianne Moore, and in the case of the kind of Boyhood versus Selma thing that I think we're going to see, Best Film, that will be relevant.
And many more categories, but is it more of a fun night?
It seems to be. I've never been, I have to admit, because I am not a movie
Neither
star.
Am I.
But people get more drunk at the Golden Globes.
It seems so.
Yeah. And you see them giving extremely drunken speeches, and they're in a room full of people they know. And also the voting membership is much smaller. It's just this strange, eccentric group of people called the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. No one entirely knows who they are, but there are only about something like 80 or 90 of them, and they make all the decisions.
Okay, Tim Robey, Daily Telegraph film critic, thank you very much. You're listening to Midori House. It's 48 minutes past the hour. Now, in October, Monocle's Tokyo Bureau moved to Tokyo's Tomigawa District. It's a charming neighbourhood, home to a mix of traditional and new businesses. There's a tatami mat maker, soba noodle restaurants, a traditional artisan lute manufacturer, along with bistros, cafes and design-minded shops. Well, throughout this week, we've been taking a stroll down the street to meet some of our neighbours. Today, we head to Sakaeya, a butcher shop run by Yoshihaki Mano, who is 70, and his younger brother, Toshimi, who is 64. Here is the elder Mano-san.
My father started this business in November 1949, and we're the second generation. It was our parents who set up shop here in November 1949, just the two of them, similar to the way we're doing things now. At that time, people were still suffering from malnutrition. This was just after the Second World War, you see. Nearby, there were some wealthy families in the house built by Lord Nabeshima, and we would knock on their doors asking if they needed any meat from us. Shops don't really do this sort of thing now, but that's how we've stayed in business for more than 60 years.
The Mano brothers' father died in spring 2011. Since then, the brothers have looked after the business, preserving what their father built. Behind the glass display case, there's a mincing machine and a ham slicer. Mano-san shows us his vacuum sealer, too. For the past two decades, the shop has sold a type of pork known as Mizuho no Imo from Ibaraki Prefecture northeast of Tokyo. The pigs are raised on feed containing sweet potatoes, and that, says Mano-san, is why the flesh doesn't smell and has less fat. The shop also sells roasted fried tonkatsu and minced meat pork cutlets, croquettes, and curry box lunches. The specialty, though, is roasted pork.
My father died in March 2011. He was 96. My younger brother and I have always worked here, and we took it over after he died, maintaining what he built. Our beef comes from a contract supplier, but we have a slaughterhouse too. We source our favourite beef from them and sell here. We also have homemade fried foods. Obviously, tonkatsu pork cutlet and also menchikatsu fried mincemeat and croquette are all made in our classic style. Our speciality is roasted pork, which we make using Mizuho no Imo pork. Not sure if the other butchers do this, but we use bits of shoulder meat. You can get up to 2 kilograms from one animal. We tie them up and brown the meat to seal in the juices. Then we cook it with our traditional homemade sauce.
In the past, the one-lane road in front of the shop was known as Omukai Street. The shops on this street used to have anything a household would need, meat or fish, or any kind of vegetables from specialty shops. Most of those shops are gone now, replaced by bars and restaurants and cafes. The makeup of Sakaya's customers has changed with the times. Which is not to say that business isn't brisk. Lunchtime on a weekday sees a steady stream of customers.
We also serve bento lunch boxes, 2 kinds a day. We rotate the menu about 20 times a month. The most popular items are sweet and sour pork and beef sukiyaki with rice. There's also the option of fried rice. One type is tamakatsu rice, which has small slices of fried pork and roasted pork and is seasoned with ketchup. I believe you can't find it anywhere else.
Sounds great. Mouth watering already. That was Yoshihaku Mano, owner of Sakaeya Butcher Shop, one of our new neighbours of Monocle's new Tokyo Bureau in Tomigawa. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Time now for our daily arts review. And today we're talking books with Alex Starrett, critic for the TLS, the Times Literary Supplement, amongst other publications. Good afternoon, good evening, Alex. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Now, what have we got today? 3 books, which aren't exactly new out this week, but are perhaps good gift ideas for the festive season.
Exactly. I mean,
should
I thought,
start with?
Particularly at this time of year, I thought we could get away from the tyranny of publishing schedules. The first one is called Naples 44. It's not new at all. It's written by Norman Lewis. And the reason I've brought it up is that I'm astonished it's not better known. Lewis was a sort of population liaison officer during the Second World War stationed in Naples. And he, for this book, essentially wrote up his diary, taking out all the boring parts. And what you get is this image of Naples that's unlike anything else that you've ever read. Naples seems only half real, half European. It's kind of oriental, it's starving. Everything is fantastical. For example, he reports that the starving Neapolitans raid the zoo, raid the aquarium for food, and grill everything apart from one baby manatee, which they can't bring themselves to murder.
Because it's too beautiful.
Because it's a baby. And, you know, kind of they have those almost human eyes.
Yeah.
And it ends up on the table of the American commander-in-chief instead.
Okay. Yeah. So this was published a few years ago. And have you read it a couple of times? Or you reread it since reading it?
Well, the reason I've read it this year, I didn't know about it either, was that Adam Fools published a novel called In the Wolf's Mouth this year. I was reviewing it and I discovered in doing some research that he ruthlessly plagiarized Naples 44, taking many of the most interesting bits and making them worse.
Okay, all right, I see that. Okay, all right, it's called Naples 44 and it's by Norman Lewis. Let's move on to Amy Sackville with Orkney. Tell me about this.
This came out in paperback this year. Also very interesting. It's about a old academic and his very young new wife who go together to one of the Orkney Islands to work and as a kind of honeymoon. And slowly you get the sense that this woman is actually a Selkie. I don't know whether you know what a Selkie is, but it's a north of Scotland word for a woman who's actually a seal in disguise.
Okay.
A sort of magical creature, famed for their beauty. And she becomes more and more like the Selkie creature in the course of the novel. You know, you start to see that the blood in her veins is green. And one of the things that makes it so interesting is the description of the sea, because she dreams about it every night. And you'll never read a better description of the sea, and you'll never get more of its power, its romance, than in this book.
Okay, wow. Sounds amazing. I presume it paints wonderful pictures of Orkneys and the area around.
Exactly. I mean, there's this kind of local shopkeeper who I have to say is a bit stereotypically miserable for my personal taste, being from the north of Scotland myself. But yeah, all those bits are there also.
Okay, and just a minute left, so let's end on a non-fiction book. H is for Hawk.
Yeah, this is one of the big hits this year. It's written by a woman called Helen MacDonald. And what it's about is that she bought this goshawk in order to help her come to terms with the death of her father, which makes it sound quite twee and plinkety-plonkety, but actually it's written at this pitch of just below screaming. She describes this bird as being a spooky, pale-eyed psychopath, which starts to go into a killing frenzy when it hears a baby crying in a supermarket. You know, it's absolutely astonishing.
And it's done pretty well. Won the Samuel Johnson Prize so far.
It has. It's one of those books that I think everyone's going to be talking about, you know, in the Book of the Year roundups. I'm sure it'll be there everywhere.
Yeah. Okay. And just in general, Alex, you think it's been a good year, actually, for interesting novels and nonfiction?
Oh, it's only been a good year for me. I've read a lot of good things. Whether that's reflective of the general situation, it's hard to say.
I think it is. No, it feels like it to me. All right, literary critic Alex Starrett, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House. And that, I'm afraid, is all we have time for on today's programme. My thanks to Alex and in particular to our special guests earlier on, Raffaello Pantucci and Shashank Joshi. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by David Pleasant and Claire Lancaster, our studio manager, Joel Church. Next, after the headlines, Andrew Tuck is here with The Urbanist. I'll be back with Emma Nelson with a Monocle Daily at 2200 hours GMT. Friday's Midori House returns same time tomorrow, that's 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, from me, Ted Kravitz, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.